This is Astir, talking music with writers and writing with musicians, hosted by me, Carly Brogan, and Joshua James Amberson.
Hey, just a quick note before you get started listening to our chat with essayist Elena Passarello. As many of you know, we've been recording remotely in the past couple months, rather than at Chaos Studios here in Portland, and so far it's been okay. It's been pretty alright, and maybe because of this easy transition, we got a little cocky, because this episode, we somehow really screwed up in the audio on our end. Sounds like we've been put on a Nokia speakerphone in 2005. Some things we said just fully didn't come through at all, and those that did sound a bit like the adults on a Charlie Brown television special. So if you're wondering what happened, the answer is we don't know. But luckily, Elena's a professional, she rolled with it, and her audio is crystal clear. It's a really fun conversation, and if you can accept some moments of subpar audio on one side of the talk, it's well worth it. Thanks for listening, and we'll get that figured out before next episode. So Carly, tell me about Elvis in your life.
Elvis, well, for me, it was my favorite Christmas song is Blue Christmas, mm-hmm. And my
classic.
Favorite Christmas album is the Elvis Christmas album, and I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but I think it's when I was a kid and we would drive to my grandmother's house on Christmas Eve, we would listen to the radio station that played Christmas music, and something about that song, there's the like background women, they're like, ooh, ooh, ooh.
Yeah.
And there's something about that I just loved. It doesn't sound totally like a Christmas song, and maybe that's why I love it. But also that it was somehow like nostalgic. It was already nostalgic for me as a kid, if that makes sense. Like
yeah.
When I heard it, it already reminded me of something else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those weird kids that was already like very much into like the past and memories, even though I was still making those. And what I think is my grandpa didn't listen to Elvis, my grandpa Frisbee, but he listened to country western music that maybe it reminded me of some of that, some of the older kind of stuff. I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, I love that song, and every Christmas I pull out my Elvis Christmas album record.
That's so
and I
great.
Listen to that while I decorate the tree.
Yeah.
What
for,
about you?
For a while, my favorite Christmas album was RuPaul's, I believe, kind of like late 90s album.
RuPaul has a 90s
yeah.
Christmas
album. Ho, ho, ho. It's really
oh
good.
God.
I listened to it for like a decade, but
yeah.
There was a number of years where I was just like, it was before Drag Race, you know,
yeah.
And like RuPaul was kind of a forgotten 90s icon for a little while
mm-hmm.
there. And
mm-hmm.
I was just like, but this Christmas album,
you
guys missed out. And
yeah.
I don't know if it holds up, but like I had a few years where I pulled that out every Christmas. Yeah, Elvis though, yeah, I really did kind of grow up with him in this way but dropped off pretty quickly. I mean, when I was just like a little kid, my mom and my uncle listened to a lot of Elvis and grew up with in large part with my grandparents, and so I kind of like just like there was just like my timeline on everything was just set back, you know, because like what like cultural touchstones were being mentioned and referred to and like what we were watching on TV was all just older than the 80s or early 90s. So I was just like Elvis in my mind, you know, as a young kid was like, you know, it's a thing of the past, but he was also like something like fresh that we talked about as well, you know? So I did have that kind of relationship, and I have been really interested to see like this, like, okay, when I was like middle school and high school in the 90s, like there was just like all these Elvis sightings, you know, and like Elvis was like talked about in this weird way of like Elvis is still
like
alive.
He's Sasquatch.
Yeah, like he's a Sasquatch. And like, and then I just feel like just especially in the last 10 years, but it's, you know, in this, in the last 20 years, like the culture's relationship to Elvis has shifted, and like we just don't, most people just don't think about him in that way. It's like too much time has passed. He's too far gone.
Yeah. Aren't there these guys who jump out of airplanes dressed as Elvis?
The flying Elvises?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. There's so many just Elvis random kitschy things, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, why we're on Elvis is we're going to spend like the next hour probably talking about Elvis, and that our guest is Elena Passarello, the Corvallis, Oregon-based essayist, and who I just adore. I'm a big fan of her as a writer and as a person. Her 2012, I think, essay collection, Let Me Clear My Throat. I came to that when it was nominated for the Oregon Book Award, and it just sounded interesting. I was just like looking at what the creative nonfiction category had to offer that year, and I was like, yeah, that sounds like a cool book, all about the human voice and all these kind of thematically connected essays. And I just really fell in love with it, and it was like kind of the idea that I had of like a book of essays that like somehow kind of spoke to each other in, but covered so much ground. And so, yeah, it's been an inspiration ever since. And then after her last book came out, Animals Strike Curious Poses, that I interviewed her for that, and then we did a reading together, and I just run into her, you know, in normal times I run into her, and we chat and have, you know, our buds now, and that's been really fun too.
Cool. I'm definitely an Elena Passarello fangirl. And that all happened at the reading that you did with her. The topic was Prince.
Yeah, it was a Prince-themed reading.
Was it like was it his birthday or an anniversary of his death? I feel like there was some reason, but maybe not.
There's a poet on tour who had a Prince-themed book.
Okay.
And I can't remember if we did it. I don't think it was his birthday, but I think it was, I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember. I do feel like there was some other kind of occasion for it, but yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it was at that reading. That was the first time I'd ever heard Elena Passarello, and it's such a treat to see her read, and I think it's her theater, or her background in theater, and she's funny, and she's entertaining, and when she's up there on the stage, you know, readings, I love readings, I go to them, I'm a writer, but they can be sometimes, you know, literally it's just somebody reading, but she gives us this energy that was mesmerizing. And she had written this piece about trying to interview Prince, and all kind of the rules about that, and it's written in the second person, and it just grabs you. And that was it. I was like, she's like she's the best reader I've ever seen read.
Yeah.
And I saw her, I saw her read at, I believe it was AWP I think I may have even been with you for this one, but she read, I'd already read this because it's from her book, Animal Strike, Curious Poses, but it was the one about Coco,
yeah,
the gorilla, which, boom, again, what a performance.
Mm-hmm.
So good. So she's a phenomenal writer, and she's smart and just funny. She's great.
Yeah, and we've both been enjoying during, at the kind of toward the beginning of the pandemic, her and her friend, the writer Justin St. Germain, started their own podcast,
mm-hmm.
I'll Find Myself When I'm Dead.
Yeah.
And we've both really been enjoying that. It's a podcast about the literary essay. And she's also the, I don't know, I always forget what her actual role is. It's not co-host. It's kind of, I think her actual title is announcer, maybe,
okay.
On Livewire,
mm-hmm.
the syndicated radio show that's recorded here in Portland, and as she took over in that role a year or so ago, and it's been really fun to just like randomly hear her on the radio,
yeah.
And she's so good in that role, and so that's been really fun. So it's she's no stranger to the radio show podcast world.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm really excited. And yeah, well, I don't think we mentioned that she's working on a book about Elvis.
Yeah.
And the playlist she sent us is entirely Elvis-based, Elvis-themed. And so the book isn't out yet or finished yet, but we're going to kind of find out what it's all about or
yeah.
what it's changed into during the course of the pandemic. And so really excited to do that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Blue moon, blue moon, keep shining bright. Blue moon, keep on shining bright. She's gonna bring me back, come on, baby, tonight. Blue moon, keep shining bright. I say blue moon, I'm Kentucky, they keep on shining. Shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. Keep on shining, shine on the one that's gone and left me blue. Well, the heat was on one moonlight night, stars shining bright, whisper on high, love, say goodbye. Blue moon, I can't forget, keep on shining, shine on the one that's gone and left me blue.
Today I realized that my ear holes, like my earring holes, are closing up.
Oh.
You haven't been putting earrings in since you're not going that much in public.
Yeah, I don't even think to do it, you know? Like, I put in a pair of earrings because we went somewhere and it was like, ow! And it's because the cartilage is growing back in my earring holes.
Wow.
So at least our cells are still generating despite all of these halting new developments.
That's a good reminder. Good. Well, maybe let's start by talking a little about your project or what your project was going to be.
Yeah, it's sort of like I made a cake, or I was working on a cake, and then halfway through the batter like fell on the floor, and now I'm like, maybe I could make a cupcake, you know. I had planned on
the book is a cupcake now.
I don't know what it is. I'm just kind of scraping the materials back into the bowl and trying to see it as a mitzvah, because, you know, as like
yeah.
All right, I mean, I think that's honest. I'm not doing it just to like please me therapeutically. Like, I do think that like there are some new opportunities that come from sort of exploding your project. But like my project was really time sensitive. I wanted my third book to do something that my first two books, which are kind of like really library oriented, they're like super researchy for the most part, where I just would go and report back about like texts that I found. I wanted to do a book where I would like try to do something, you know, like where I would go out kind of like George Plimpton or something and
yeah.
try to accomplish something. And the first thing that I wanted to do was try to become the world's first prominent female Elvis impersonator, although they prefer to be called tribute artists. But then I spent several months kind of traveling around and watching these ETAs. And I came to the conclusion that I would not be able to compete, even though, you know, I have a performance background and I'm totally not afraid of making a fool of myself. This is like a multi-million dollar industry of really like fabulously trained people. And, you know, Elvis is a baritone, and there were just certain things about it that I didn't smell like a book anymore. So then the next thing that I tried to do, and this was sort of the project that I went into 2020 thinking I was going to do, Elvis died before I was born, but just right before I was born. I'm pretty sure that I was conceived the same weekend that Elvis played his last show. And my mom was pregnant with me when he died. And so were these, but even though I never knew, I was never alive when he was alive. He was basically alive through my whole youth because I'm a child of baby boomers, and like all of pop culture was still so obsessed with him. And so he's, and then
and he's being kept alive on the pages of tabloids, Weekly World News, you know. I mean
I don't know how old you are, Josh, you're timeless, but like if you're like, it was on, like I was forced to know about Elvis, like Saved by the Bell, Screech's mother had an Elvis bust, and you know, Full House, Uncle Jesse was obsessed with Elvis, and he was, you know, our McDonald's in Gwinnett County, Georgia was called Elvis McDonald's because it had been thrown up on with like Elvis stuff, and he was always on the radio, and
that's amazing.
It was a pretty cool McDonald's, I have to say. But so I don't know. I don't ever remember not knowing who he was. And, you know, like when my family did the chili cook-off at Stone Mountain in Georgia, our booth was Elvis themed. And I always knew him as this kind of joke as well as this kind of like revered thing. And then I realized that not only was I never alive when he was, but he and I have the same initials and we're both Southerners, and, you know, then he died when he was 42, and because of, and then that would mean that 2020 would be the first year that Elvis has been dead longer than he was alive. So his afterlife, this thing that indoctrinated me into who Elvis was, would actually be older than the physical body that lived on this planet. And that happened also the same year that I turned 42. So it just felt like this kind of like, oh, well, you're going to spend 2020 going around and talking to people and having experiences about that have to deal with Elvis's legacy, this thing that was built for my generation and the generations that followed, although not so much so. I think the Gen Xers and the early millennials really got it hardcore. And you're going to visit with all of these opportunities in Elvis's afterlife. So I was going to go on an Elvis cruise, and I was going to go to this Church of Elvis in Canada, and I was going to go, there was a big nonfiction conference in New Zealand. And so he's huge in Australia. So I was going to go spend some time in Australia, and I was going to, you know, follow around a lot of Elvis impersonators. And then, you know, COVID happened. So I'm spending the year that Elvis has been dead longer than he was alive alone in my house. So I'm sort of, that's the cake batter situation. Does that make sense?
I got it now.
Yeah, for sure. So, but it sounds like from what you wrote to us that you were able to get some things in there before COVID hit. Is that true?
Yeah, I did. I went and spent the night in Elvis's teenage bedroom in the Lauderdale Courts Apartments in Memphis. Yeah.
How did that work out?
It's really funny. It's not very loudly advertised, but Lauderdale Courts is where his family moved when they moved up from Tupelo when Elvis was about 14. And I think that's right. Maybe he was a little younger, but it was a subsidized housing for white Memphis residents, because this is still, Memphis was segregated, and it's right downtown, and it's like a bunch of kind of two-story buildings with courtyards all around it. And it's since been kind of transformed into like kind of like multi-income level housing. So a lot of like college students live there or young professionals. And there's just the apartment that he lived in with his parents, they just rent it out. So you just go to like the rental office and you give them like $150. You go, and it's interesting. I mean, it's really interesting. I can give you more details if you want. It's not like they always kept it exactly like that. Like it had another life in between when Elvis lived there and it became this sort of tourist opportunity. But the walls are covered in kisses and there's this guest book that's just like, you know, just full of people from all over the world who have come and like are spending all this time there. There's this weird drawer that has like guitar picks and things that people leave. And so I went there next week I'm going to watch all 31 of Elvis's films back to back over Labor Day weekend.
Oh my God.
So pray for me.
Yeah. How many have you watched, do you think? I mean, maybe it's hard to gauge because they played on TV a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Time, but do you have a sense of how many you've seen?
The whole way through?
Yeah.
Fewer than 5, I would say.
Okay.
Isn't that crazy? Okay. Like, I mean, but yeah, remember they used to be on TV on like TNT or whatever. Like it was like New Year's Day. They would be on for like, it was like a Christmas story. They just showed them all. So I would get, and then since I've been researching Elvis for the past like 3 years, I've seen clips of a lot of them and I have favorites. And, but yeah, I've never, it's really hard to watch an Elvis movie from beginning to end. Except for Viva Las Vegas, which is kind of great. And I mean, there are other ones that are pretty great. Like I think Jailhouse Rock is really good. And King Creole is pretty good. But yeah, I mean, like some of them are so, they're hard to find right now. Like, you know, like I think one of them I'm going to have to watch in German on Vimeo. I think it's maybe his second to last film, Charo. I think maybe that's it. But yeah, so it's going to be, and then I got this cookbook called like Cooking with the King, and my partner is going to is going to make me like peanut butter and banana sandwiches, and I'm going to just be in this bunker like
yeah.
And he was a big fan of bacon and tomato sandwiches. He sometimes would eat especially when he was really young and vigorous, he would eat like 4 of them. And so I special ordered my favorite mayonnaise from South Carolina, Duke's mayonnaise.
Oh, right. Duke's. I know some people who don't really like that.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, it's so good. Yeah. And then the big one is, and I haven't told really anybody this, so this is a Steer exclusive.
Okay.
On Leap Day, like literally like the week before the pandemic started, the last thing that I did before I went into lockdown was I flew to Las Vegas with my partner of 17 years, and we got married by an Elvis impersonator on February 29th. So that was sort of that, and the spending the night in his apartment were like the January and February activities. And then, you know, March and April and May and June and stuff none of those things ended up being possible. Like,
So wait, you didn't tell people about the Vegas wedding, or you just...
No, it's a secret.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, not like, it's not like a, I mean, we told a couple of people, we told our families, and they were like, my mother said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, and I'm not going to mention it to any of my friends.
Whoa. The Vegas Elvis part was the stupid part.
Yeah. And like, you know, like David and I moved in together in 2003. And I think they're just like, you old people just need to get yourselves together.
Yeah.
Like, I also like, I have issues with marriage, you know, like I'm, it's not my thing. And so, and Elvis did too, right? Like he was divorced within 6 years of when he said I do in Las Vegas in 1967. And so I thought it would be interesting to sort of like go get married and confront that. And that is something that I can write about in the pandemic. So I can write about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it's just like, it's not just that I'm stuck here, that the project is cake on the floor. It's also, you know, like, what a year to even think about this figure, Elvis, who's this sort of like shorthand for American whiteness and, you know, who is the product of a racist and segregated music industry that very obviously marketed him as an option for white listening that appropriated black originated music. I mean, among other things, I think Elvis did a lot of things, but I mean, it's, you can't deny that, you know, that was what was at stake, or that was what was at play when Elvis became who Elvis was, right? Like the first thing that happened after he recorded That's All Right Mama was he got interviewed by a local DJ who asked him what high school he went to, because he wanted the local listening audience to understand what race he was, right? He recorded That's All Right Mama in a studio that featured a lot of African-American musicians who couldn't go to the cafe next door. Sam Phillips had to go get food for them because they weren't allowed in, right? So when you were recording, you know, like, so, and then it just goes on and on and on, you know, the Colonel and other people sort of worked very diligently to keep him out of the R&B charts, even though he charted really high kind of early on. But anyway, this is me
that
being...
The Colonel is his... kind of like career-long manager, the guy who discovered him, right?
Well, he sort of launched him to sort of a more national stardom. Elvis started out with this guy named Sam Phillips at the Sun Recording Studio. He just like walked in one day and cut a record for like $3. And Sam Phillips and his too often forgotten business partner and who's Marion Keyser, they sort of remembered him and then brought him back in and recorded, you know, he recorded his first few dozen songs there. And then he got too big, you know, for a small recording label like Sun to distribute. And the Colonel offered him, you know, $1 million a year in like 1956. And so from the late 50s onward, the Colonel was Elvis's manager. Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, I mean, the long story short is that like it's good, I think, to have the cake on the floor when you're thinking about Elvis, because I think it can't just be just this cutesy thing where I'm like, you know, going and getting married and, you know, going to Graceland and crying with all the people from all over the planet, which I also did, which was really amazing on the anniversary of his death. I think the cake that's on the floor is this project of like, interrogating my own whiteness, my own misogyny, and like the idea that he is this champion of a monoculture, which is also something that I've understood forever too, because that Chuck D Public Enemy song, you know, came out when I was in fifth grade. So when he was being made fun of on Saved by the Bell, I also learned to motherfuck him and John Wayne. So
fight the power. Subject.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a Vivian Bormick thing, right?
Yeah, I think so. The, like, I forget the
authentic and the
apparent.
Apparent. Yeah.
The like, what it is on the surface. Like, you're writing a book about Elvis, and it's the apparent subject is Elvis, and then, but it's really about something else. It's becoming about something else. It's kind of like,
oh yeah,
through the kitsch, you're being led to a more authentic subject.
Well, Elvis this is interesting you bring this up, because to me, Elvis is, I mean, probably to everybody, he's more of a symbol than mm-hmm. and a cultural icon, as we already know, than even a musician. Like, I feel like that his, and I don't mean even necessarily like because he acted and performed and did other things. It's like he was, I feel like, a symbol for all of these sort of, it's funny because it's sort of like all of everything American, whether it's like patriotic or like fiercely unpatriotic. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were, when he first started making music, I think it was J. Edgar Hoover who said that he was like a threat to the security of the nation because of like teenage rebellion or what they called race mingling.
Sure. Yeah. Things
like, you yeah. know, and just, yeah, immoral sexuality, things like that. Mm-hmm. But just in so many other ways, like how he never rose to gain the respect. Like, he's always kind of a joke. He's like the comedy and the tragedy, mm-hmm. not like a Shakespearean tragedy that, and, or comedy that ends in marriage, but literally like he's kind of a joke. And he's also this like tragic hero mm-hmm. who died at 42. Like, he mm-hmm. could never rise above his socioeconomic status, so he never gained that respect. He's always kind of associated with poor white trash, glitz, mm-hmm. shiny trashiness, I feel mm-hmm. like, in a way that's, I think over the years has become like aesthetically punk and like cool, but mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of his fans, it's a fanship that's has a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think Elvis is an ultimate apparent subject. I think mm-hmm. in all of the ways that you just outlined and about 75 billion more, people use Elvis to do something else. And it makes it very difficult to write about, but it's fascinating because I do think like there are people that are obviously working through their own issues with family members who suffered from addiction through the way that they consume Elvis material, right? There are people who are trying to think about an America that doesn't exist anymore through their worship of Elvis. And there are people who, I love that, that, I mean, people who are trying to be punk and push, right? Push through that, like, I mean, I think like Elvis is an example, right? Like when he's on the playlist, like, that I think he's, it makes him dissolve so frequently. Over the past 3 years, I really, every time I think I'm onto something, I realize that like he's just so big, and he is you know, he's like Whitman or Montaigne or something. Like, he, you know how when you read Montaigne, he says he's one way on one page and then you turn and he's another way on another page, and it's because he doesn't exist. Like, there are people for whom Elvis is the most faithful, true blue husband and father in the world, you know, on all these Facebook groups that I begrudgingly follow. And then there are people who think that he represents like this freewheeling sexuality and that, you know, like this just like uber masculinity, you know. There are people who see him as this sort of neutered figure, and it's just, he's an apparent subject. Yeah. Carly, it's totally right.
He is like a strange, like my husband the other night was like, oh, you know, he did like die of like a drug overdose on a toilet seat. And I'm like, but he was also like kind of staunchly against drugs. It's like he didn't mm-hmm. even, I feel like he didn't know. Like, it was, I mean, a lot for him, I think, too, was maybe this sort of blind trust in so-called experts and doctors. And,
yeah.
You know, which is another sort of ill of America. Like,
yeah.
That can add into the list that I feel like Elvis symbolizes. Mm-hmm.
The whole obsession with fame, then like him kind of being like this turning point in our modern rock and roll style obsession with fame. And we were talking before the show and just saying that, you know, like, Elvis was this cultural moment and cultural turning point.
Mm-hmm.
And in a similar way to the Beatles, but the Beatles kind of rose to the level of artist, you know, fairly soon after, more than just being
like a boy band,
mm-hmm. or, you know, cultural icons. And artist, and Elvis never really had that artist moment, you know, like he like went down rather than up as his career went on. So he just kind of stayed firmly as a famous figure in the cultural mind. And, you know, I think that's part of why he like became kitsch and became interpreted mm-hmm. in all these ways and became an apparent subject for so many other things, so many other aspects of American life.
I think too, he made some decisions. I mean, I would argue that there's a huge difference between Elvis and the Beatles. I think he's more like Sinatra in that he didn't write his own stuff, right? Like Elvis, right. Elvis has songwriting credit on a few songs, but he never, that was just the Colonel's licensing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, he never wrote anything. He worked with some of the greatest songwriters in the world, like Kris Kristofferson and Lieber and Stoller, who wrote Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock. Marty Robbins, right? And I think he's a notable interpreter of two decades worth of songwriting material, from the sort of blues material and the country material like Bill Monroe in the early times, to sort of this like 60s swingin' movie making stuff, to the 70s singer songwriters that he sort of worked into his live, you know, the 70s were his period of live performance. And I do think that if we think Frank Sinatra is an artist for the reasons that he did this interpretation over multiple formats, I think we can consider Elvis in the same way. But like, because of the rock thing and because of the sex thing and because of this, well, the screaming girls were, you know, Frank Sinatra invented that. They used to have to like change out the theater seats at the theater where he had a residency in New York because these young girls kept on peeing on them. Yeah, the James Kaplan Frank Sinatra biography is amazing. If you ever wanted to read, I mean, the Peter Gorelnik's Elvis biography is the best, I think. And James Kaplan's Frank Sinatra biography is the best of his many, 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 many tomes. But anyway, yeah, I mean, so like, I don't know, I think it was maybe Carly or maybe it was Joshua, I don't know. Like earlier we were talking about how like he's known so much more for his iconography than for his music. And I think that was exactly how I was brought up, right? Like, yeah. I just knew the like four songs that they always played on the oldies station, and like that, like, you know, like people would do like the Rockettes would do like a show, a tribute to or whatever. But then in my 30s, I started paying more attention to, you know, because I was ironically into Elvis, right? Like in my 20s and 30s. And then I started listening to, you know, like the stuff that he did in the concert years, and there's so much more happening. It's all really weird, and but like there's so much about his music that I didn't know anything about until I was, you know, quite old. And it's insane that I mean, not a day probably went by in my entire life where somebody didn't mention Elvis Presley, but I didn't hear, you know, You Gave Me a Mountain or Poke Salad Annie or, you know, by Tony Joe White, who's one of my favorite songwriters of all time, until I was, you know, like I'd voted in two or three presidential elections, right?
Yeah, we were talking about that, the playlist you sent us, which is really interesting in a lot of ways. You know, you had songs about Elvis, songs by Elvis, mm-hmm. songs that were written with Elvis in mind, and songs that you imagined that you would hope would love to hear Elvis sing.
Yes.
That came after he died. So there was a lot going on in the playlist, but
sorry.
We loved it, but that there was like we commented on how the Elvis songs were such deep cuts, and a lot of them were from later in his career. A lot of them were live. Several of them were live, and so yeah. And we were kind of talking about how that, you know, came up, and how that you've been working on this project and probably listening to so much Elvis and like finding these things in the weeds. And mm-hmm. yeah, what, I mean, it seems like your relationship to his music is different than most people. Your favorite songs are different than most people at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many of these are actually my favorites, but they are. I thought it would be interesting to bring some of them in because I wanted to sort of like ping a couple of boxes in the breadth of what he did. Like Elvis only won one Grammy while he was alive, and it was for his gospel album, right? For best gospel recording. And, you know, he played something like 9 billion shows between 1970 and 1977. With these huge bands, you know, that grew bigger and bigger and bigger as they moved further, and they became, you know, he became a real kind of like vocal showman. So I tried to pick some things that, and the other thing is like, so I started going to all these Elvis impersonator competitions where, I mean, some of the prizes are like, you know, $25,000, $50,000. And, you know, people fly from all over the world to do it. And they're, you know, the champion right now is like 22 years old, Latinx man. So it's crazy. And I think the watching them do young Elvis is rarely as satisfying as watching them do jumpsuit Elvis. So, because I think young Elvis, like Sun Records Elvis, was sort of fire in a bottle. And I think that's really hard to replicate. You don't want to see somebody replicate that kind of spontaneity, but jumpsuit Elvis, live Elvis, it's a different kind of performance. And I mean, I just fell in love with the sort of 70s, like I call them divorcee songs, like these like depressed, like Kris Kristofferson, you know. And speaking of Kris Kristofferson, Elvis was the first person who was offered that role in the Barbra Streisand version of A Star Is Born, the Bradley Cooper part. And he really wanted to do it, but Colonel drove a stupid bargain and wouldn't, so he didn't get the gig. I love those. The Elvis tribute artist community loves those songs. Like You Gave Me a Mountain, Kentucky Rain, Help Me Make It Through the Night. And I do too. I mean, I think Carly said this about comedy Elvis and tragedy Elvis. And I have used those terms myself. When you said it, Carly, I was like, oh my God. But I used it in the more, like you said, like the Shakespeare sense. Like comedy Elvis is the Elvis that's this like firecracker exploding out of the Louisiana hayride, and you know, Ed Sullivan trying to shoot him from the waist up. And it's just like this like trajectory going into outer space that like connects to consumer culture and youth culture, and this great exhale when the children of the baby boom are getting old enough that people think, the white children of the baby boom, they think, you know, maybe the war is behind them, right? All of that is just like this arrow going upward. And then and after things happen to him in the, you know, after like, you know, in the late jumpsuit stages of his career, early jumpsuit is spectacular. From Comeback Special to 71, I mean, your mind would die. This skinny guy in a fringe jumpsuit doing cartwheels and like just chest and just like, I mean, like foxy as hell, like really, yeah. Really, and beautiful singing. My favorite Elvis album is from 69, but later, you know, 72, 73, 74, 75, you see a man, you know, fighting in a way that is, it feels like the world is sort of like weighing him down, and he's singing song, and the nation is feeling that way too, right? The 70s and the songs that are coming his way feel that way. You Gave Me a Mountain is like about like, Lord, you gave me a mountain that I can't climb. My woman took my baby boy away. You know, it's just like, what? And like always on my mind, you know, maybe I didn't do it right, but you were always on my mind. And you have the, you know, the jumpsuits are getting bigger and heavier, and his signified dance moves are getting, they're more kind of indicative of the fact that he has chronic back pain. And so when you see an Elvis impersonator in the jumpsuit doing these later songs and doing these moves, they're showing a man struggling with gravity. So that's the tragedy Elvis for me. And I think that is something that's worth paying close attention to in terms of like apparent subject is like, you know, like, like somebody who was 16 in 1955 that saw him at the Louisiana hayride, that's then seeing him, you know, in Sioux City at his last concert in June of 1977, is taking that journey with him. And, and that I don't know, for me, like I'm rambling, but like the music that's really drawing to me right now is the tragedy Elvis music, because I think, and that and like the artistry music like Elvis in Memphis, because I think, I don't know, I just think that it just gets really big in my face, like it sort of just grills my cheese and yeah.
I think there's a little bit of more real, and this is kind of a theory I have, that our cultural obsession with Elvis is kind of, we're trying to figure out who he is, and maybe he was trying to figure out who he is. There's something, mm-hmm. and I don't mean this meanly at all, but there's something sort of empty, or like we project onto him, mm-hmm. and like that's why he has this like mythos, this that's like bigger than any other performance artist I can think of, like his appearances, mm-hmm. as like, you know, the apparition that comes to Clarence Worley in True Romance, like some fairy godmother, right?
Right.
Or what's that other movie? Oh, like the Jim Jarmusch Mystery Train, the two Japanese kids that are like, you know, Carl Perkins, no, it's Elvis Presley. And they're like going to Memphis to like have this Elvis dream.
Yeah.
I just feel like he is more than anybody else I can think of. I mean, there are huge artists, but it's not like you see like a figure of John Lennon show up in movies. And they, like, that's just not a thing. And it feels to me like we are collectively trying to like relive him or feel who he is, or, and that's why there's all the, maybe the impersonators and the iconography and the obsessions. And I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to, and I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that. Cause
yeah, I mean, I think it's like Jesus, you know, like I think there has to be an empty space for the audience to get in. Like you have these big tent poles of meaning, right? And then there's got to be a trough so that you can go in and say, no, you know, Elvis is a man of God. Elvis loved everyone. This is a big thing right now, you know, when I go to the shows, is Elvis loved everybody. It didn't matter who you were. And then the impersonator sings Walk a Mile in My Shoes, you know, or, you know, Elvis, you know, loved his mama or whatever. Like you have to crawl into, or Elvis is America, right? Like you have to have something to sort of crawl into and inject the self. And you know, like, and Lester Bangs, I don't know, did you ever read the, what he wrote basically the week or the month that Elvis died?
I didn't.
It's one of my favorite pieces of, or it was always one of my favorite pieces of music criticism. It set me on it made me want to write about music, but it's beautifully written. He talks about seeing Elvis like years before he died, and how he was very aroused, but it wasn't, you know, Lester Bangs is the guy that Philip Seymour Hoffman plays in Almost Famous. And so you have to imagine Phil Hoffman saying that. He was like, I wasn't sexually aroused. It was more an erection of the heart. and then of course Elvis lets him down and he's very depressed, but he says in his obituary, you know, we will never agree on anything again the way we agreed on Elvis. And I sort of entered this project feeling that way, like feeling like, yeah, Elvis is the last thing, when, you know, back when there were three channels and music had to be on a physical object and, you know, like ever. But of course now that we is a monoculture that never really existed, right? Like there's a lot of we's that are going to be like, no, I wasn't agreeing on Elvis, right?
Yeah.
Like, and then B, that agreement that people were having was much more personalized, I think, than I thought when I entered this project. And I think it's because of that bowl, that empty space, you know, like not everybody was getting an erection of the heart, as Lester Bangs said, like the agreement was just like it is with any faith. Like it was deeply personalized and also largely codified.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we listen to a song?
Oh, right. This is a music podcast, right? I guess.
Yeah. Well, no, we can talk.
Did any of the songs strike y'all at all? And Elvis or not?
Well, it's funny. I've written about the Gillian Welch song before in a,
really?
It's not in a piece that's been published. That song, I just love that song. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of my my favorites. And that sort of sparked for me, when I first heard it, revisiting, or not even revisiting, because honestly, I was never really like an Elvis fan. I was like not an Elvis hater. I just wasn't really an Elvis fan. But then I loved that song so much, and it made me want to like kind of be like, you know, here's Gillian Welch writing this like beautiful song about Elvis Presley. And it just, I can't remember the lyrics exactly, but like, I just think of him as like thundering and shaking, and just like wanted to listen to Elvis then. And I went through a period where I was like listening to some Elvis music, just that song.
I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? Just a country boy that combed his hair and put on a shirt his mother made and went on. And it shook it like a Harlem queen. It shook it like a midnight rambler, baby, like you never seen, like you never seen, never seen. I was thinking that night about Elvis.
Elaine, I'm curious, have you listened at all to it's a revisionist history, Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, and he has an episode that I listened to maybe like 6 months ago about Elvis. I'm curious if you've heard that one.
Is it the one where he's kind of digging into the fact that Elvis keeps forgetting his the speech? Yeah, and then he goes and hangs out with Jack White.
Yes, yeah. That's the one. It's funny because I listened to that, yeah, like you said, whenever it aired, it may have even been like a year ago or something, but that was so sad, like heartbreaking, mostly just like learning that he would, I don't know if you've heard it, Joshua, but he would lay in bed, he would make his bedroom like pitch black with blackout curtains, and it was cold and dark, and he would lay in bed for days with Priscilla, just like even ordering food from bed, like Priscilla described it as like he wanted it as like a cocoon or a womb even. Mm-hmm. And then here's this guy who was like this mama's boy. Apparently he would baby talk with his mom. And I don't know. I think that it was such a troubled person. He was also a twin he was a single twin. I don't know what you call that. Like his brother died, was stillborn. So I just think he was like a deeply, deeply troubled man as well. And we just I don't know how much we know that as like a collective, you know, as a culture, but it was interesting to me. Also, I heard that in that podcast that like he and Priscilla didn't even have sex for 6 years. Hmm. I don't know how true that is. But
yeah, no, you know, in her biography, she, I mean, I don't think she speaks in absolutes, but like they had a pretty their marriage lost its sense of affection, and they were never around each other because he really kept her at bay. That's true. And he you know, he also, I think the other thing about it is that he couldn't go anywhere from when he was 19 forward. Like half the reason that he bought Graceland was so his mama could sit on the porch. Because he bought a nice house on Audubon Drive for the family. Didn't live with his family, never. And they stole the laundry off the line. And this is before the Colonel even picked up with him. This is back when he was still kind of like the king of the hayseeds, the hillbilly cat. And so Graceland was a property that was very far off of the main road, so she could sit on the porch and keep her chickens, which is something that he always wanted to give her, along with a car. He bought her a car that she never drove because she couldn't drive. So, but from that point on, he couldn't eat, you know, he couldn't go out to eat. He would rent out movie theaters and roller skating rinks and amusement parks for his friends. And he didn't love being alone anyway. But I think when you have to think about Elvis sort of like making these cocoons for himself in Las Vegas and at Graceland, it's in reaction to the fact that like, he didn't have a sense of normalcy, even when he was in the army, even in Germany, you know, there were people sort of like beating the door down and he had to make like a visitation hour so that all these German kids could come see him. I think about the other celebrities for whom that's the case. Like, you know, we look at Michael Jackson, you know, who is a very problematic figure, of course, as was Elvis, you know, in terms of, you know, his relationships with young people, young women. I think there are a lot of the people that are sort of like lionized, like Marilyn Monroe, like they couldn't go anywhere. Like they were just like stuck. He was all along. That's the Gillian Welch, right? He was all alone in a long decline, thinking how happy John Henry was when he fell down and died, right? Just evoking the myth of this guy who was a prisoner. Created this superhuman Herculean bodily act that beat a machine, but really, like, once it happened and once he beat it, like, his heart exploded and it must have felt good. Like, like, yeah. Good job, Gillian. I think that song came out when I was living with my best friend Patrick shortly out of college, and we had like jokey velvet Elvises on the wall, and everybody knew that Patrick was kind of ironically into Elvis. And then she put that song out, that album, which is one of the most important albums of my life, definitely more important than any Elvis album. And, it was like, I was living in this like post 90s ironic bunker and this like voice of faith and wonder, like, just came through. And you know, it's like 2/3 of the way through the album, and it was just like, oh, what would it be like just to think deeply about Elvis as an energy, as a real energy,
right? You know? Yeah, it's like the first time I think I'd heard Elvis being sung about, or at least that I knew of, because for really quickly, the song Tupelo by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and the Dylan one you gave us, I never knew. And Joshua was saying this too. I had no idea those songs were even about Elvis. But as far as I knew, when Elvis was mentioned in songs, like I knew like the X song that's on there, where it's kind of not so much about Elvis, or it's kind of funny, or it's tragic, but this was just, it's like a serious, beautiful song.
Yeah. And it can't, I mean, as an essayist, like you can't run away from like, I was thinking, this is a real Zadie Smith move, you know, like, I was thinking about this, like, and then she then creates this amazing sort of like implicit connection and also this like, like very expansive commentary, but it just begins with this like, and I think she's so smart to do that.
Like, oh, I totally,
I'm surprised she didn't. I mean, I'm not trying to ever, like, I would never be like, what? You didn't know that? But I think maybe because of my upbringing, like, there's only one thing that came out of Tupelo. So if a king was born in Tupelo, like the Nick Cave song, like, but like, is it maybe not? I think you guys are younger than I am. Like, is that one of the things that is sort of like not necessarily. We don't all agree that's common knowledge.
I'm older than you are, by the way. And
what? Oh, you sound like a wee bairn.
I'm 44. Oh. So I was 2 when Elvis died. Not that I remember when Elvis died. My family wasn't here. I have an aunt who's very into Elvis and actually collected Elvis memorabilia and Elvis iconography. An aunt on my dad's side through marriage. But in terms of my parents, there was never any Elvis in the house. I've never seen an Elvis movie. You know, I had never really heard Elvis except for like if it was on a soundtrack of a movie or something like that.
Where did you grow up, if you don't mind me asking?
I grew up in Santa Rosa, California.
Oh, right. My I didn't know that you were 44. My first love was from Santa Rosa, and I think he's almost exactly your age. We'll have to.
What is his name?
His mom. We would do that off camera. I don't want to out him. He's like married and happy now. And his mom, I will tell you, his mom ran the local costume shop, Disguise the Limit.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember Disguise the Limit. I used to go there and get fun. They had a lot of like gag gift kind of shit, you know?
At that costume shop, every year Tom Waits would come in with his kids on Halloween, and he always rented the same costume.
What did he rent, do you know?
What did he go as?
Like, what costume would Tom Waits rent yearly?
Well, I mean, I know the answer, but what would you think? I always ask this question. Oh,
okay, I'm gonna say, and by the way, just for the record, like I used to make Tom Waits's coffee or juice every morning.
Maybe he was in costume. No, you would know.
I've never seen him in costume. Man,
I almost want to guess something kind of unexpected, like something cutesy or, you know, not scary in that.
Yes.
Kind of push against his image. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what that would be.
Like a bunny rabbit costume.
That's a good guess. I like that.
He went as, and he had young kids at the time, or youngish kids, so I wonder if that also contributed to it. But he would always want to go, or he'd always go as the Tin Man. That was his.
Oh. And I can actually kind of maybe picture that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. As far as, I mean, I grew up, my mom really loved early Elvis. Mm. And we had this cassette of like his early hits, you know, and it was one of those really long ones, you know, it had like 20 plus songs. And we would just let that flip. And this is when I was pretty young, but she was painting houses as a side gig, exteriors of houses. And I would go with her and just hang out in the lawn while she painted. And we would listen to that tape. Well, it's in my memory every time. So I really did have this really strong early relationship with Elvis. But I didn't know, until you sent the project description for your book, that I didn't know he was born in Tupelo. I'd never heard of Tupelo outside the Nick Cave song. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's like, I mean, I grew up in Washington State. So, so maybe it's a kind of regional thing.
I think Southerners we're probably a little more, because my parents were not Elvis fans at all. They were too young. But I think we probably got it laid on thicker than most folks.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think so. But, Nick Cave loves Elvis. I don't know. Do you guys follow those Red Hand files that he does?
Yeah.
Oh, Nick Cave. I mean, like, one of the biggest tragedies about Elvis, I think, is that he didn't get to find, like, I don't know how to say this. I don't want to insult what Elvis did in the last few years of his life, but the Guralnick biography, which is really responsible, sort of like indicates that he's just kind of lost his mojo. Like, and so does the Priscilla's book. And, he had a hard time finding ways to sort of like energize himself. And, you know, Elvis is not he's not a hero to me. And I don't idolize him, but I think I do have a lot of like rock male heroes, and they're the people like Nick Cave and David Bowie who find these ways to become elder statesmen, you know, and they're new and fresh and fucked up. And, you know, like Bowie's dying breath was better art than 99% of the population will ever make in their life, you know?
Yeah.
And Nick Cave is doing this Red Hands file thing where he's like doing this weird advice column and saying just the most beautiful stuff. He started a TV channel of people doing Bad Seeds covers. He's selling erotic wallpaper, and he made Grinder Man in his 50s, like the rockin'est band. So.
I saw Nick Cave in the Bad Seeds play, oh man, I don't know how many years ago it was now. It was when Dig Dig Lazarus Dig came out, and God, they fucking rock. I mean, it's like, obviously I didn't have the chance to see him, or I mean, maybe not obviously, maybe I could have, but I mean, that was my first time seeing him. It was so powerful and strong and so fucking good and demonic. And I loved every bit of it. And it wasn't like seeing some has been older, know, late in his career dude. It was just, it was mesmerizing.
Yeah.
And I mean, Warren Ellis, from he is kind of his side man for all the new Nick Cave stuff. And I'm just a huge Dirty Free fan.
They're me too.
Favorite bands. And so though I haven't loved the later Nick Cave stuff, I haven't gotten into it as much. I do kind of appreciate, you know, what they're doing. Like I watched at least one of the documentaries that came out in recent years. And there was so much Warren Ellis, and I was just like, and they were talking about their creative process and, you know, and I was just like mesmerized. I thought it was so cool.
You didn't see him in Portland when he was supposed to come through again, but he obviously got COVIDed, but the most recent Portland show, maybe 2 years ago. Is it the Arlene Schnitzler, which is like where, you know, the symphony plays or whatever. And he was walking on the hands of the crowd. Like everyone was invited down. It was terrifying. There's these cell phone videos of all of that concert tour where you can feel like you're right there kind of holding him up. And it's a crazy, evil, beautiful, loving, like, it's really something. And, you know, he talks about Elvis, the jumpsuit Elvis is his favorite. And he talks about sort of like the ability to become, you know, this other person that then asks for this connection with people is something that's always both fascinated him and terrified him, because he talks about this in this Red Hand file. He talks about it in a New York Times article that came out about 5 years ago. But, you know, he thinks in order for people to like love the performer that much, the performer has to kind of disappear. You know, and
back to the Jesus thing we were talking about, or you mentioned earlier, it makes me wonder if Nick Cave's sort of obsession with or love for Jesus, and I'm not trying to like downplay religion, I mean, but you know, I wonder if that even comes out of the same exact place.
Oh yeah, I think so. You know, I think, apparently when he and the Bad Seeds a while ago, like in the 80s or 90s, they played in Memphis and they all went to Graceland, and he wouldn't go inside. He just sat outside the gates while everybody went in, because he just got, it's in the New York Times profile of him from a couple years ago, which also spends a lot of time talking about him and Warren Ellis and the way that they work together, which is, it's great. But it was just too much for him.
Fuck, man.
Yeah. It's a great song too. That Tupelo. He's got a couple songs about Elvis, but
dark and good.
Yeah.
You said he has a couple songs about Elvis?
Yeah, Saint Huck is apparently about Elvis as well. Which is like, that might even be a birthday party song. I can look it up. But that one doesn't grill my cheese the way Tupelo does. I think Tupelo is interesting because I like Nick Cave when he rolls with meter, you know, like when it's just this tumbling of phrasology and it just sort of like feels like a tremor worm. Remember that movie Tremors? Now that I know that we're all the same age, where like you could see the worm going like underneath the ground, and it's like, that's lyrically what's happening. And you know, with, you know, this is back in the Mick Harvey times, and Mick Harvey was so good at building momentum. And you know, it's this like this lightning storm, because Elvis was born during a terrible lightning storm. And you know, as Carly said, you know, had a twin brother, Jesse Garin, who died. And you know, I think Nick thinks that Nick Cave thinks that like he sucked the life of the twin, which is something that Elvis, you know, people say Elvis lamented about for a long time. And and I think the song does that. Like the song is like talking about this lightning storm and this sort of like transference of energy. And it's like, and it's the Jesus, right? The king is born, but it's also this just like this menace, this murderous menace. It's just, yeah, it's so good.
I was curious, so you didn't want to read anything from the project, right?
No.
Yeah, you're not ready, and that's totally fine. Not going to put the pressure on that one.
Thank you.
But I was curious. I mean, it sounds like from the project description that you're still kind of working on your Elvis act. Is that true?
Yes. Like my performing Elvis act?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, how's that coming along?
Oh, terribly. You know.
Okay.
I think I'm gonna have to go. I think I'm gonna have to go not avant-garde, but I think I'm gonna have to go like eccentric. You know, like I'm gonna have to go kind of circus freak about it. And so I'm
okay.
You know, like I wanted to go through like the Premier League was my original intention. Cause I'm a pretty, you know, one time I learned a bit that there was this screaming contest where you scream Stella, and a woman had never won it in like 30 years. It's at the Tennessee Williams Festival in New Orleans. And so I was like, I'm going to go down there and I won, right? Like, and I became I'm not the last female to win. Quite a few have won since, but, so I was like, yeah, I could do this. I was very confident, but I do think that like I can't do what these guys do. And I don't think that I would be welcome. And I'm not the type of person who would like just kind of be like, hey guys, you know. like Plimpton was, you know. So, but there are these like other ways to play Elvis, and I've been sort of, and other ways to be coached into how to play Elvis. So there's an amazing theater director that I'm connected to named Dan Jamet. He lives in Paris, and he's kind of obsessed with Elvis, and he's working on a film and so he wants to have a sort of irreverent Elvis, and so we're trying to figure out if it's like a short film, if I can play Elvis in that. And a friend of mine has written a play that where Elvis kind of plays like a tiny, he's like on stage a lot, but he doesn't do much. And I'm trying to see if I can, he'll let me play Elvis, but I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to just, well, and there are also like these amateur competitions that I could enter, like, and I might just sort of do that. But it's, you know, he's hard to sing. He's, you know, I don't think that he was the greatest singer of all time, like his fans say. I think he was, but I think Prince is one of the greatest singers of all time, though. But I it's hard to sing, especially even though I have a deep voice, like it's hard to hit a lot of the notes that he hits.
Yeah.
My body can't do anything anymore. Like my, you know, Elvis's pelvis is so important. And as a 42-year-old woman who's been sitting in a chair for the past decade, like none of those muscles work anymore. Like I can't.
Like since you've switched from mainly acting to mainly writing,
mm-hmm.
things have changed.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I mean, basically my injury is, you know, the muscle that you would need to use to twerk is like my, it completely is unfunctional on me now. And a lot of that in that area, I think a lot of Elvis's, even when he was doing jumpsuit stuff, like I think he had pretty loose hips. I don't know how that, I don't know. So, definitely have to do, and I'm really not shaped like him, you know, just because I'm chubby, I'm not fat like Elvis was fat, and I'm definitely not thin like Elvis was thin. So when I wear a jumpsuit, I look like a lady in a jumpsuit. Like it looks, and then when I try to sing like Elvis, I sound like Cher.
I mean, that sounds pretty cool to me. Yeah,
you think? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it was, I mean, it's sounding like that your Elvis is, I mean, and this is true of all the, I want to say impersonator, but I know that's not true, tribute artists.
The
right?
Tribute artist, yes.
Yes. And use the acronym earlier, ETA, right?
Mm-hmm. Is that what it is? Yeah, the ETA world, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the most famous ETAs, if you're interested, are this guy named Dean Z. He's good. I love Victor Trevino, who's a kind of punk rock Elvis, but he's really? Still pretty traditional. And in his heyday, there was a guy named, this is his real name, Cody Ray Slaughter. And if you look him up, like Cody Ray Slaughter, ETA Finals 2011, he does a young Elvis that actually makes you get a little rumble in your bathing suit parts. Like it's a real... it's really hard to capture that thing, and most people don't, and you know, like, but yeah, so I like but I would definitely like Dean Z is a really good, and Dwight Eisenhower, which is also a person's name, he's probably the best vocal Elvis. But anyway, you were asking me a question, Joshua, and I just interrupted you.
So. Well, I was going to say that's all good to know. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure so many listeners are going to follow up and go deep into the rabbit hole of ETAs, but I was going to try to convince you to sing something, but it seems like maybe your performance is like you need it as a performance.
Yeah, and I hate the way it sounds right now, honestly. Like I sing as Elvis to myself basically anytime David's gone. I like practice songs and I sing like him, and I maybe one day I'll like the way it sounds, but I don't like it enough yet, you know, like, but when I do, I promise I'll do it for you.
All right. We'll have you back.
I'll tell you the song that I would do though is on the playlist. It's Bossa Nova Baby. That's the song I could do.
Okay. That's an interesting one. not what I would expect.
I said, take it easy, baby, I worked all day and my feet feel just like lead. You got my shirt tail flying all over the place and the sweat popping out of my head. She said, hey, bossa nova, baby, keep on working, for this ain't no time to quit. She said, go, bossa nova, baby, keep on dancing, I'm about to have myself a fit. Bossa nova, bossa nova.
Why that one?
Well, it's a little higher in the register. Yeah. Right. So, like that. That's just the highest note in there, which is much higher than like Jumpsuit Elvis. It was written by Lieber and Stoller, who I think if people like Lieber and Stoller had got to stay in Elvis's life, the Colonel sort of like bargained them away. You know, I think if he would have had more songs like to record, like that, they wrote Smokey Joe's Cafe, they wrote Hound Dog. I think that it would have been really good for him. And you know, the Dolly Parton thing, he was desperate to record I Will Always Love You, but the Colonel was like, I want all the licensing for it. And Dolly Parton, who's, you know, one of the greatest businesswomen who's ever lived, one of the greatest business people who's ever lived. She was like, sorry. I mean, it would have meant the world for her to have Elvis cover her song, and Elvis would have crushed it. He would have annihilated it. And, anyway, but yeah, so, but, and the other thing is that, when I watch people do Bossa Nova Baby, I think I could be better than them because of my dumb voice training, because it's really percussive, you know. I said, oh, wait a minute, baby, dupa, dupa, you know, and it has all these like little pops and it's fast. And I think the articulations would make it sort of pop. I think I could do that, but yeah. So that's why I picked, and the costume is very affordable. It's just a sport coat.
Oh, great. Yeah. Keep it simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like we could talk for ever.
I know.
It's Elvis, man. He he makes you go on.
How long were Elvis's shows? Were they really long?
Well, it depends on when they were. Often he was doing two or three a night, so they were usually about ish an hour, but sometimes, I mean, he would, like, when things were bad, he would just monologue about the wallpaper, you know, or just kind of like say crazy things around the time of like when Gladwell was sort of interested in that performance that Gladwell talked about in the podcast. But well, another thing that's kind of funny is sometimes they got shorter and shorter. Like Poke Salad Annie is at this, the one that I showed you is at this really nice rhythm. It's in like 71, but by 74, Poke Salad Annie was like half as long because they just sped it up so much. Like by the time it was over, Hound Dog was like, yeah, you know about Hound Dog, cried all the time. You don't know about Hound Dog, cried all the time. It was like the Chipmunks version. So Madison Square Garden was quite short, for example.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like, you know, we've already gone over the length of an Elvis show. So
right. We're reaching the crazy when he was crazy and just monologue. Like, that's the only actual Elvis impersonation that I've been able to do is when Elvis was like off his rocker and talking about the wallpaper at the International Hotel. So I guess
that seems like uncharted waters there, you know, like that's like an ETA performance that maybe those happen, but it seems like those would be uncommon.
That's my niche. There it is.
You've got it.
Thank y'all for helping me. What a breakthrough. Like that now I know I have a direction.
The book's basically done now.
Done. You know? Yeah. Call Simon and Schuster.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there how far along can you tell how far along you are in this book?
I am hoping to have the first three chapters solidified by like Halloween. And I bet you it'll probably be about 15 chapters. So that's not great. But for me, like based on the other books that I've written, once the first three get locked down, the book starts to make requests of itself. You know what I mean? And things move more quickly when someone else is bossing me around. In the beginning, I have to kind of boss myself around and I don't ever come up with the great ideas, but once the book sort of knows itself, it goes quicker.
Yeah. And do you have a publishing date or anything?
No, nothing.
Yeah, no. Okay.
And honestly, like, I don't even know. I still am not convinced that the world needs an Elvis book right now. Like, so I'm just doing it right now for me. And maybe it just turns into a couple of interesting essays. And I was not fine with that 6 months ago, but now I'm fine with that. Right. Like it's just sort of like a weird trip that I'm on, you know?
Yeah. I really love, I mean, I remember talking to you, interviewing you for your last book and you talking about just kind of how long you sit with ideas before they become book projects, you know, that. And so when you were talking about kind of living in a like Elvis kitsch group house in the 90s or something, and thinking deeply or thinking about what it would be like to think deeply about Elvis, it seemed right in line with all your other books, you know, that there's something that you've spent a lot of time thinking about, that's like you're not pulling this out of thin air. It's like been kind of a continual subject. Maybe just to wrap up, is there an Elvis song that you want us, that could take us out, that could close the show?
A closer. Mm-hmm. Well, so Elvis closed usually with Can't Help Falling in Love, which is what the Elvis impersonator walked me down the aisle to. And he recorded that song 17 years to the day before I was born. But I think we shouldn't do that one because that's too much. So why don't we do the Clam? I'll add it to the
great
the
playlist. Yeah.
So Do the Clam is a terrible song that was in a movie that he made in 1967 called Clam Bake. And for all the wonderful Elvis songs that there are in the world, there's a song devoted to yoga that he sings with the original Bride of Frankenstein, Elsa Lancaster. But I think maybe the worst Elvis song of all time is this one, Do the Clam. I am very excited to force you to listen to it right now.
Everybody gather around and listen to that bongo sound. Grab the first one in your reach. Now we're gonna shake the beach.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do the clam, do the clam. Grab your barefoot baby by the hand. Turn and tease, hug and squeeze. Dig right in and do the clam. You can't get your heart to spin on the outside looking in. Moon ain't gonna last all night. Well, let's work up an appetite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do the clam, do the clam. Grab your barefoot baby by the hand. Turn and tease, hug and squeeze. Dig right in and do the clam. Listen to those happy feet.
Listen to those happy feet.
Ain't you glad that you found out?
Ain't you glad that you found out?
What the clown is all about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do the clown, do the clown. Well, I'll grab your barefoot baby by the hand. Turn and tease, hug and squeeze. Dig right in and do the clown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do the clown, do the clown.
Recorded for now remotely from various homes in Portland, Oregon. It can be heard through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, as well as our website. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. New episodes come out every 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us.